This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, our guest has been called the quintessential American sports writer. And he just celebrated a birthday. Get ready for some epic stories, Celtics fans. But first, Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Thank you, Darlene. If you followed sports over the past half century, you know our guest well. Bob Ryan, who spent 43 years at the Boston Globe and has been a fixture on ESPN for decades, is our special guest. He also has two podcasts still, one with Mike Lupica and Mitch Albom, his longtime comrades on the Sports Reporters, and another with Jeff Goodman, who we were colleagues at ESPN, a great basketball mind, especially in the Northeast. Welcome, Bob. Thanks for sharing some time with us.
Mike, nice to be back with you. Great. Thank you.
I don't think I've seen you in person since, David Stern's memorial service at Radio City Music Hall. Yep. And what a day that was. But in a weird kind of crazy setting, that as the NBA led the world last year in depression, that just seemed to start a trend of lousy life happenings, some of which happened to be around basketball, but much of which happened to be around America in the last year. I wouldn't even know the country a year from now if I had spoken to you then.
It's one of my last circumstances, my last milestones. Last time I was in New York, which I had visited frequently for 50 years, and I have not been to New York since. That was about the third week in January. It was the week before the Kobe Bryant passing, the Kobe Bryant crash and death, which has horrified all the basketball community. And so one of my milestones, I haven't now, it's been over a year since I've been in an airplane, over a year since I've been in New York, over a year since I've been outside of New England. And we all, we're all living in this circumstance, but I certainly think about David frequently. And all he meant to the league, all he meant, he was certainly someone I admired and looked up and enjoyed his companionship. I'm not going to be so pretentious to say we were good friends at all. We certainly were good, solid acquaintances. I feel terrible about David as well. But all this stuff comes in, together. As we approach the first, I call it the Rudy Gobert Day, which I guess was either March 11th or 12th when the NBA shut down. I happened to be watching the game at the Big East, which was shut down at halftime, which during the Big East tournament. It was a Marquette St. John's, whoever it was. And we're approaching that final milestone of a year into this, horrifying pandemic that has altered our lives, not only temporarily, but in a certain sense, as we all had better know forever.
It's hard to even begin to where to start with you. I didn't get to know you until, I guess, Michael Jordan's second incarnation in the league, when I started, I guess, at the New York Times in 1994. And there were many Bob Ryan years before that. I threw out on Twitter, I go, look, I know Bob more peripherally than closely, but I feel like I feel like he's a good guy. And I asked people, if you had one question for him, and of course they were all Celtics related, but I'm just curious, belated happy birthday. You're 75. I know you were born in New Jersey, and I don't know if you had, teams were in Philadelphia at that time. Tell people how you got to Boston that don't know. I know it's an old story for people in Beantown, but the audience might not know.
Well, a very simple reason is I went to Boston College. the basketball knowledge that I gained there because Bob Cousy was the coach and I got to know him, and it really influenced me greatly in terms of how I learned about, you know, so it's the nuances of basketball. I was the play-by-play announcer for the radio station for 4 years. I worked for the new school paper for 3 years, but I did get to make the acquaintance of Bob Cousy, who still remains one today. He's 92 years old. He's very facile. I got to Boston that way. And I worked for the school paper, and I was able, through the auspices of the school sports information director and the public relations director at the school when I was a senior, to get an interview for an internship at the Boston Globe. And my roommate, Reed Oslin, that had the first dibs on that because he was actually the official aide of the sports information. Mm. He was not going to go into journalism as a career. And they said, well, we have another guy. Well, I was the other guy. And I got that job with the Globe, and that started it in the summer of '68. The very first day on the job, June 10, '68, I met a guy named Peter Gammons, the name you might be familiar with.
And just a little.
He was a fellow intern out of North Carolina. He hadn't graduated yet. I was a rarity, you know. I don't know if you ever interned or not, but
I did.
But interns, generally speaking, are undergraduates, not graduates. And yeah, it took me as a graduate, and I didn't know what was going to be the upshot of it. I hoped I could stay, but I had no guarantee. Anyway, Peter was, he still had another semester to go at Carolina, and he finally graduated in January of the following year. Anyway, Peter and I met that day, June 10, '68, and I hit it off. He was a Groton preppy. I was a Lawrenceville school preppy. You know, we had that bond. We both liked basketball, but we both loved baseball. And that was our bond right away, baseball and the preppy thing. And we've been friends ever since. So that's how I got to Boston. And it turned out to be incredibly fortunate in many ways.
So you started on the first day of the job as Peter Gammons. I thought it was Will McDonough. Maybe that was wrong.
Oh, he was well entrenched by that time.
Oh, that's true.
Willie's older than us, the late Will McDonough. He was already entrenched as a Patriot guru, but he also had his fingers everywhere. He was very close to Carl Yastrzemski. He was very close to Joe Cronin, who was then the president of the American League. He was not close to Billy Sullivan. They became that was funny. I could tell you a story about that down the road if you'd like. But no, not Will. But it was Peter, we're separated by a few months in age.
What a staff at the time. I mean, Gammons, Will McDonough, Lee Montville.
Well, I want to say,
Leslie Visser too.
Came later. We really coalesced with the powerhouse staff in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And there was a point in time in the mid 80s, and I don't think any newspaper in America, and I think this, I can say this with great degree of certainty, before or since we'll ever be able to say what I'm about to say, that each of the four people who were the primary people on associated with the four major team sports, football, basketball, baseball, hockey, each of us, football, Will McDonough, baseball, Peter Gammons, hockey, Francis Rosa, and basketball, me, Bob Ryan, we all became inducted into the writer's wings of each of those four halls of fame. And we were concurrent. And
that's tremendous.
I don't think there's nobody else can make that statement.
And especially now that I don't know when it happened, and I'd still like to see to you on this, but I feel like at some point in the early 2000s, when we were stupid enough as major metropolitan newspapers to give away our content and instead of charging men. And so the Huffington Post and all these mom and pop shops bought up people and said, hey, we can actually do this if they're just going to give it away free. But newspapers were king, man. Newspapers were king. You could make big money in TV journalism. And of course, when you started going on with Roy Firestone and the sports reporters, there was some ancillary income possibilities. But the bottom line was that was still always the bread and butter. And if you were, I got out of school in 88. But I remember thinking, you know, like if I ever got a sports columnist job at a newspaper, my life was set. You didn't want another job.
Papers were the king. They were the currency. And everything revolved around newspapers. And then slowly television, local television began to get into the act and all that. But this is before we had insiders with national television. Will McDonough being one of the first ones. He was identified by Terry O'Neill, who brought him in I don't know whether it was NBC first and then CBS, wherever Terry went, but you know, the legendary Terry O'Neill, but he brought Will. Will was really the pioneer of all of them. Bud Collins, who was another colleague of mine, the greatest tennis writer in American, in English, you know, American history, and the most beloved tennis writer among all the people in the tennis world in the history. He was one of ours. He was one of my mentors.
Oh, yeah, Bud. What Bud was great. Bud
well,
was
he
great.
Started doing a little TV commentary for Channel 2, the public station in Boston, in the mid-70s, and then it blossomed into this and that, and eventually he left the Globe to go to NBC as a full-time, because he was writing for Tennis World.
Yeah.
But he went into full-time television and made it a living. Then eventually Leslie Visser left us to go to television and made it a living. Meanwhile, I got involved with ESPN. Peter got involved and then later went to ESPN and on and on and on it went. But we were, the Globe was really an incubator for a lot of this. So you consider that Willie, myself, Leslie, Peter, all of us started at the Globe and wound up having associations with television and got this all thing off the ground. But back to the paper thing. Papers were the currency. They were the way that people, and the columnist was the king. Columnist set the tone. Columnist set the agenda. Later, local radio, talk radio, co-opted that from us. But what did they do? First thing they did, they hired writers to provide expertise.
Sure.
Soon, there was a point in time I used to laugh when if you were a columnist in America and you didn't have a radio show or were a part of one, you know, you were a nobody. Every market in America co-opted the local columnist or one of them to get on local radio, if not full-time, then part-time. And I was part of that too.
Well, when I got out of school, I just remember thinking, if I could be Bob Ryan, if I could be Mitch Albom, if I could be Mike Lupica, Jim Murray, like that was a career goal. Nowadays, kids get out of school and they're like, can I be Stephen A? Can I be, and which is not a bad aspiration, but there was a dues paying thing, and it was called working the locker room, working your sources, and all the things that journalism was. And I'm blown away by the success of someone you know real well, Bill Simmons, who used to boast loudly that he never went into the locker room, and he somehow tapped into that. Yep. Wait a minute, now the fans are not getting this access they need. We need someone who just wants to go off on guys it's a new genre, and I'm glad for him. But I, being an old school newspaper guy, I still miss the relationships that were built to come up with those stories.
Let me back it up. All of us in my time, as you pointed out, I'm 75, and I go back to the late 60s, the Western Union era, as I like to say. That, if you like,
teletype.
All of us started out, among other things, covering high schools. There's no doubt. Yeah. Almost every one of us. And as well, and I was covering Celtics full-time and high schools concurrently in the early 70s. And, you know, we a lot of this came up in Twitter not too long ago. I don't know who brought it up. And I said, you know, high school sports meant, I said, walking the sidelines in the high school football game, keeping your own stats and kneeling in the mud, you know. And that's exactly what I did. And that's what we can all relate to the circumstances of covering high schools. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. That's not the path anymore. That's how we all got started. And it's all different now. Of course, it's all different now. Everybody now wants to be Sheffy, and they want to be Woj, you know, and that's fine. That's the goal now. Those are the kings. And of course, Sheffy and Woj are newspaper guys at the core. You know, I knew Adrian Wojnarowski when he was in Danbury, Connecticut.
Waterbury.
Waterbury.
Yeah, I knew him at Waterbury. I knew him at the Fresno Bee.
He went to New Jersey. Sheffy was at the Denver, whatever, Post, whichever one in Denver. And then, you know, but that's how they got started. And Buster Olney, Buster was for the New York Times.
Yeah.
And that, all these information guys. And, of course, the original one, the godfather of them all, was Will McDonough. He was the first one that a major network plucked to become the insider. And he still was working for the Globe.
Oh yeah, and he had he still had the fedora on, and
that's the old world. And you're right. That's not the way it is now. The stars are those guys that we just mentioned, and others I'm talking about ESPN because I'm part of ESPN. But you know, obviously Fox has their own, and so on and so forth. Yeah,
Ryan,
life changes. I'm just glad I did what I did when I did it. And I was a beneficiary. I'm still a beneficiary beneficiary of those of that, because I've still got a podcast, and our podcast that Mike and Mitch and I do is a result of being one of the sports reporters for 29 years. And now we've transferred it, thanks to Mitch's, you know, entrepreneurship, into a podcast.
Literary empire, Mitch Albom. Oh. I was going to ask you we had Ryan McDonough on, obviously Will's son, and he was just great. And he would give all these stories about his dad, and including, I mean, you couldn't make this up. Like, you know, like Will would go visit Whitey in prison in Leavenworth.
Yes.
Like, you can't make that up. You can't make that story up.
Will McDonough grew up in South Boston, and he knew the Bulger family, and Whitey, who became one of the greatest notorious gangster in the history of Boston, and Billy, who became the president of the state Senate. Angels with 30 Faces movie, and art imitates, you know, life imitates art. And Billy Bulger, at the same time that his brother was the most notorious criminal in Boston, was the president of the state Senate in Massachusetts. And Willie had been Billy Bulger's first campaign manager when he ran for state rep many, 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 many years ago.
That's great.
He with those guys. So we always kid Willie about, you know damn right well where Whitey is, you know, but you're not telling. And he probably did. But but here's one of the greatest, there's so many stories. There are so many stories.
Yeah,
but
I know.
Willie, beyond everything else, Willie and I lived in the same town. He lived about a mile from where we are sitting right now.
And that's great.
And I was the kid Ryan. I have kidded Ryan, who did a podcast with Jeff and myself, Jeff Good and myself, last fall.
Yeah.
Ryan McDonough is the only major sports executive in history that I attended his christening. when Willie and his wife Denise had brought Ryan, we were invited to the christening.
That will make you feel old.
Yeah, and Ryan McDonough. So I knew Ryan when.
No, that's
a story. Although that's only one of my two favorite stories. That's one. The other one is, and I'm just jumping.
Yeah, no, this is great.
This is my favorite. This is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Paul Silas and I became very friendly when he was playing for the Celtics. I was a very
great one of the greatest people I met in my career.
Thank you. So glad to hear you say that. It's one of the great men I've ever known. And when he was in Seattle, after he left the Celtics, I went out there, you know, I was on duty, and I went out to visit him, and Paul at their house. And young Steven was a toddler, and I played Nerf ball on my knees in the living room with Steven Silas, who was now the coach of the Houston Rockets.
Oh, man.
That's how you know you've been around for a while.
I can't believe I'm going to admit this on my own podcast, but and I hope this doesn't get around. I actually dated Paula Silas, his daughter, for a little bit in New Jersey. While I was covering the Nets, and I was at the New York Times, and she was, and great, great young woman. I just got scared that if it went wrong, Paul Silas was going to beat the shit out of me. So I almost found a way, like, that I was too busy and I was going to be on the road for a long time. And to this day, I regret it, Bob, because while I hate the idea that, you know, people breed for genetics and all those things, with my Division III genes and her NBA genes, we could have done something.
I mentioned, I said Paul when I met Carolyn. Carolyn is Mrs. Is
her mother. Carolyn. And Carolyn, by the way, one of the nicest people of all time.
Carolyn's your mother, and Paul. But Paul Silas is one of my favorite people of all time that I ever covered, I still stay in touch with him today. But I played Nerf ball on my knees with Steven Silas in the living room in Seattle. And, you know, we all have our little stories. You know?
And now he's coaching John Wall. The guy who I really like is a little bit of a knucklehead still, and he just got rid of Boogie Cousins.
Yes.
I love it. This is great. All this stuff. People listening to this right now are going, "Why is you idiot? I know you know Bob Ryan a little bit. Why haven't you got to the Celtics already?" And so I do need to get there. I mean this in all honesty. I think of nobody alive that has more institutional knowledge about the Boston Celtics than yourself. And I wondered I wanted to ask you a few things, because obviously Bruce Bernstein, my producer, Bruce, you can jump on now because you are a fan more than you are a journalist in this case. I know you love the Celtics. I want you to ask Bob Ryan the first Celtics related question, because I think coming from you, it'll even be more appropriate.
I'm so honored. Bob, in between my two stints at ESPN, I worked at NBC Sports for the 1992 Olympics. And while I was there, I had the incredible pleasure of spending about an hour with John Havlicek and his wife, Beth, who you obviously know very well. And I remember, I went to my first Celtics game in 66, okay? It was against the St. Louis Hawks. It was a doubleheader. There was like some Israeli Olympic team was playing the first game against somebody. And then the second game was the St. Louis Hawks against the Celtics, okay? Yep. And when I was talking to Hondo in 92, I asked him, true or false, the 1973 team, the team that went 68-14 and then lost to the Knicks in the Eastern Finals after Havlicek got nailed by Dave DeBuscher on that screen.
Right.
True or false, was that the best Celtics team of those vintage teams that won the two championships? And Hondo said yes. And I'm wondering what your feeling about that is.
Unequivocally, yes. They would have wiped out the Lakers, whom they had swept in a regular season. And Cowens averaged 30 points and 19 rebounds a game in the four games against the aging, immobile Wilt Chamberlain that year. And now the Knicks went on to beat the Lakers as well. And they deserved to beat them. But the Celtics would have done the same thing. So, yeah, that was the best team. And Havlicek got hurt, and then he missed game four, which they lost in double overtime, losing a 16-point lead, entering the fourth with the worst officiating in the history of all the universe.
John Gianelli. That's all I got to say.
John made a pretty good play.
But he was a hacker.
Jake O'Donnell and Jack Madden screwed the Celtics beyond all belief. And it wasn't just a Celtic opinion. I'll never forget the great late Jack Kaiser of the Philadelphia Daily News writing that he called it the rape of Madison Square, quote unquote. You can go look it up. So I'm not being parochial when I say this.
I don't know if he gets away with that today.
They were screwed by the refereeing was atrocious that let the Knicks win the game. All right, they win the game. Game five, Havlicek now playing with his left hand only, scores 18 points. And they win. Silas makes two big free throws. They win game six. Havlicek, though, now the Knicks are catching on a little bit. He only scores 9 points, I think, in this game with his left hand. And then in game seven at Boston, at this point, they had never lost a game seven. John comes off the bench, and they want to make him pay. He can't do anything. He's got his left arm. They were too deferential, respectful in the first inning, five and six. They force him into turnovers and you know, they take advantage of him, which they should have. They'd win the game. And the other thing that people should have, Dean Memminger had the game of his life.
Dean the Dream.
And they win 94-78. They kicked the Celtics' ass. But Dean the Dream had a great, great game. And the Knicks won to win a championship, which they deserved. But the Celtics would have done the same thing. Yes, they win it in 74 with not as good a team. They win it in 76 with not as good a team. Absolutely. That 68-14 game was better than the 74 and 76 teams.
So Mike Wise, Bob Ryan, John Havlicek, and yours truly all agree that team got
the best
Celtics team of the 70s.
Well, and not only that, maybe the greatest team ever to not win a title. In that, it's got to be in a category of about five, because you got I'm trying to think.
The Warriors won 73. They didn't win.
What's that?
Right? The Warriors.
Oh yeah, the Warriors winning 73. You're right. That has to.
I'll be willing to start with that.
Yeah. You're right. And then you got to go. Shoot. Then you got to go to that Suns team that got screwed out of the playoffs that year with Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire. And the Kings. The Kings of Chris Webber and Mike Bibby.
Maybe the next year, you know, when the suspensions when they come off the bench.
Oh, the 97.
Patrick can't play.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was of the opinion that they had Michael's number that year, and that team could have won.
I think they had a real, real, real shot. But I know that 68-14 team, that team, that moments, oh my God, some of the stuff they did, that is as good a running team, a pure artistic running team as there was in those days, as well as anything that the Lakers had done. They won 68. They were, oh my God, and Cowens was the MVP. John, it was But anyway, he got caught in a pinch between DeBuscher and Bradley in game three and hurt his shoulder and hurt his, you know, and he had to play with one, his right shoulder, excuse me, and had to play with one arm the rest of the way. So John's right, Bruce. John, great. Best team of that era.
This comes from a Larry Irving, and I don't want to sound like one of those, Jiffy Pop Pop. Paul, the best six man in Celtics history, John Havlicek, Frank Ramsey, Sam Jones, or I'm going to say your favorite, Bill Walton, but tell me.
Well, John was the quintessential, the greatest six man that ever was or will
be. Who?
Havlicek was the greatest.
Oh, yeah, Hondo, you got to.
Being employed as a six man and then still playing second and minutes played in those years only to Russell. You know, it was a strategic thing that Ray was able to employ because of the depth of his team. Okay. And actually, you know, Tom Heinsohn, some people don't realize this. And when he took over in 69-70, he tried to keep John in the first couple of games in that six-man role until he realized it was ridiculous. You know, you can't do it. We're not good enough to do this anymore. And then John went out leading the league in minutes played for a couple of years. Seriously. So,
okay.
All right. So, but Walton, I'm glad you brought up Walton. In 85-86, the reason why I think the Celtics are the greatest team in the pre-three-point mania era. I will concede the Warriors as the best team of the three-point mania era when the game when the game has been changed into something totally different than it was the last 10 or 12 years. No team ever brought a specific force, the nature of Bill Walton off the bench, other than the 85-86 Celtics. He changed the game in the ways that no six man before or since has ever done. It gave them the greatest 1-2 punch at the five position the history of the league has ever known that year. And now the five position has been devalued. And I would love to know what would happen if that team could come back today and say, okay, we're playing our way and you're playing your way. And let's find out, you know, and I mean that. I'd like to know. No team today, I'm telling you, could stop the Parrish McHale Bird front line.
There's
team constructed to do that.
I agree. They were just skilled. They were tough.
And they were skilled in a way that no team today has anything like that. Now, Now, today it's all guarding the perimeter and the three. And by the way, the Celtics had guys who could make threes. Bird was a three-point shooter. DJ could make it. Danny led the league in percentage one year, most of the year. He could shoot. Scott Wedman was a three-point shooter. They could have adjusted. If they had to play the way they play today, Larry, you think Wade would have been happy taking 10 or 12 threes instead of three or four? He would have been happy to do that if you had to do that.
I think some people will say you're out of your mind. The Bulls of the 90s.
We got the Bulls.
I'm with you. I'm done with the Bulls.
No, I'm going to tell you something, Mike. I used to do a bar little thing I used to do. I get out the napkin and I write down 10 or 12 names. Okay. And I would say to people, what do these names have in common? And I mean, like one person maybe ever figured it out. No one figured. And it were names like Walton, Worthy, Wilkes, Wedman, Rodman, on and on and on. The answer was each of those guys came off the bench in a regular cup check. And off the bench in a regular capacity for each of the four teams who won the championships in the 80s.
That's great. That's a great stat.
One year, they all legitimately came off the bench. And I say that team, Vinny Johnson, I mentioned him, oh my God, Ainge.
Microwave.
That team would have beaten any of the Bulls teams.
I agree with you.
Would have beaten any of the Bulls teams. And the point being, expansion, you know, created a dilution of talent on teams. No team today could bring out. Can you imagine being able to bring those kind of guys off the bench today?
The
one guy in our time that I put up and I really think he's a borderline Hall of Famer, and I would advocate it because of is Lou Williams. Lou Williams would is in that category, and if you can name me another one, go ahead, I'll listen. But that's it.
Yeah, I'm gonna be from the Mutual Admiration Club here. I can't disagree with you. I when you look at what they could do, the physicalness, I mean, they went four, when a team never went 40-1 at home, they went 40-1 at home that year. Those 85-86 Celtics did. And Larry Bird was at the top of his powers. He was at the very height of his powers. It was his, I believe that was his third year in a row that he'd won the MVP. Right. Right. I mean, I look at, you know, the fork in the roads of how he could have easily ended up with six titles. Everybody says greatest Celtic of all time. You take eras. It's easy to, I always say when people say, who's the Mount Rushmore? I go, you got a Mount Rushmore centers. You got a Mount Rushmore players. They're just different. I like Bird because he could do so much. You know, everybody will say Bill Russell because he was the greatest winner of all time. Where does Bob Ryan stand on this?
Well, they're different. You know, the centers, I always categorize centers to, there's no argument about Russell being the greatest winner of all time in the history of American team sports. You know, I mean, let's just be serious here. From 1955 until 1969, from 55, his junior year at 54-55, his junior year at USF, and through the last year of his Celtic tenure in 1969, he competed for 16 championships, two NCAA, one Olympic, and 13 NBA. His teams won 14 of those 16, and he was the primary reason for that. And the only one year of the two that he did not win, he was hurt. And only people in St. Louis would be stubborn enough to concede that if Russell had been healthy in 58, the Celtics would have beaten the Hawks. So he got beat once legitimately. In 1967, Wilt was at the peak of his powers in his second phase, which is his all-around phase. And they beat the Celtics in five games, and that was legitimate and fair and square, and no argument. Celtics came back and beat them the next 2 years. And Russell went out as a champion, 69. All right, they're different. Look, the skill set of a center is different than the skill set of a mid-range player or forward or a guard. They're different. I mean, so that argument, I always like to parse that argument. When we're talking about greatest, the GOAT, we're talking about all around skills. And now we're down to two people. We're down to Michael and Magic. I mean, you know, it's Michael and Magic. The most
What about LeBron?
I said Magic. Oh my God. I meant LeBron. The jury was
75.
Michael and LeBron. All right, Michael and LeBron. And here's the way I wrote about this in my book, which is now 7 years old. Nothing's changed. The idea is this. LeBron is bigger, stronger, faster, better passer, better rebounder, and when he puts his mind to it, can play some pretty damn good defense. Michael was all right. But if I got to play for my life tonight, I want Michael.
I love that line because it reminds me of the old Mike and the Mad Dog in New York. They go, gun to the head, Mike, gun to the head. Who you like?
The most ruthless competitor, the cut your heart out and give it to you with a glass of Chianti. That's Michael. That's not LeBron. LeBron is a nice human being, totally team-oriented, had to be kicked and screamed into taking over.
This is great. You're so right.
Between the two, Michael won it all in the NBA when he learned to share. Then 88 Michael is not making those passes to Paxson and Kerr that won those championships. All right?
Yeah,
LeBron didn't win until after the debacle of the pure debacles of 2010 when I was there and he quit, and 2011 when he shied away from the ball against the Mavericks.
Oh.
That LeBron doesn't exist anymore.
Painful.
That was the catharsis. So he didn't win until he learned to accept the responsibility of being the best player on the floor and acting accordingly, picking the spots to act accordingly. He has learned that lesson. And we're seeing it over and over again right now at age 36. Nobody ever has played at 36 as amazingly as well as LeBron. And I looked it all up. I'm telling you,
I bet.
LeBron has right now. This 36-year-old LeBron is phenomenal. This LeBron is better and much more, you know, more into it than the LeBron of 2010-11.
All right. Another fanboy question. This one from a Mike W. in Chevy Chase, Maryland. The best Celtics starting five Bob Ryan has seen in the history of covering the...
Before we get to that, one question. Do I get to cheat and make Havlicek a sixth man because of his unique ability, or do I have to...
It's Hondo. How can you exclude Hondo?
Do I have to pick a five?
Right.
When I do, I cheat. Because if I have to pick a five, I will. Okay. Obviously, Russell, Bird, McHale, Cousy.
Ooh.
And then if I can put John as sixth man, just because Havlicek and Sam is the other guard. But if I can't, then John's the other guard. There's no problem.
See, I would have said, and maybe it's because I covered some of these games up close, and I think everybody's a little prejudicial to their own era. I would have picked you for, let's see, Bird, Parrish, Bird, Russell. I would say the truth was in there. Paul Pierce somewhere. And then I would have went Cousy probably. And
well, see, that's different. Yeah. That's different. See, you want a basketball five, or do you want...
What about KG?
Or do you want the Rushmore plus one? What do you want?
There's different. Okay, all right.
I've been
almost need two teams in the Celtics.
You know, in the Celtics Rushmore thing, you know, the fifth guy, the four are clear. Russell, yeah. Right? Bird, Cousy, Havlicek. There's Celtic historical. The next question is, who's next? And I've been through this, and much as I love Kevin and I love Dave Cowan, and I love Sam, the answer next up is Pierce. Yeah, he's five. But I don't put him, he's not starting over Havlicek if I have to pick a big guard. No, he's not.
Yeah.
He's not. Sorry. People understand how amazing Havlicek was. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. That's... Look, no one's going to argue with you on that.
Now, the fact is, if I had a... John had turned himself into such an all-around player that you could put him at the point and make Pierce the, you know, and kick Kuz out if you want, but I can't kick Kuz out for historical purposes. You can't.
And he was so... He was...
For purposes, we're talking about... the Celtics wouldn't have existed for Russell to make them champions if Cousy hadn't been around to bring the fans in the first six years.
Oh, he was a wizard. He was Marcus Haynes. He was
Mr. Basketball.
He was Mr. Basketball.
Boston was and remains, by the way, a hockey town to this day. And first and foremost, and the only reason the Celtics were even have any life at all and exist for Russell to come in 56 is Cousy. Cousy, yeah. Whole raison d'etre for the Celtics from 1950 to 1956.
Some Celtics legends have passed on in the last year plus. John Havlicek, 2019. Then last year, Casey Jones, Paul Westphal, Tommy Heinsohn.
Yeah.
You know, the Celtics franchise also experienced deaths of a different nature with Reggie Lewis and Len Bias during your time covering the team. Every name I just mentioned was in your circle one way or another. Any thoughts that really come out?
Well, I mean, so many, you know, first of all, Westphal was a personal friend. I broke every rule that journalism is supposed to have, supposedly, by becoming friends with a player and crossing over that line. And I'm a human being first. I said, I'm a writer second, and I'm sorry. I and I hit it off well. And of course, the story that people are aware of, that in the 1976 finals, after Tommy Heinsohn and I were having a little, I don't remember how it came about, frankly, Mike, whether he invited me or I invited myself, I don't know. But at the games 2, 3 and 6 of the 76 finals against the Suns, I didn't stay at a hotel. I stayed in 552 West Burridge Lane, Phoenix, Arizona, Shea Westphal. And he had a nice little cabana out by the pool. So I had my own room, my own private setup. And I stayed at Westphal's house.
Well, this answers a question Bruce wrote for me, which is, you know, what you clashed with Tommy. Was it because you were both from Jersey? Like, no, your problem with Tommy was you left him for Westy during the finals.
Well, that was after we had our final little blow up in the game.
Yeah.
To summarize the Heinsohn thing, when I started out in '69, he was a mentor in a way, I learned a lot of NBA from him. We spent a lot of time together, a lot of cups of coffee, a lot of airport lounges, a lot of this, a lot of that. I learned a lot from Tommy. But I also was culturing relationships with the players. And as time went on, it turned out that some of the things that I was learning from the players and the way they were looking at things were different from the way Tommy was looking at things. And when I decided I liked their viewpoint, or I thought that they were right, more than right, that he was wrong. And when I would write this, Tommy got angry, which is understandable. And long story short, our relationship deteriorated over the years, and it finally deteriorated firmly in the 76 finals. And early on, and that's when I decided I'll stay at Westfall's house instead. And now, long story short, we patched it up. And for the last 42 years of his life, from 1978 until he died in the last fall, we were friendly. And hanging in our living room right upstairs above me right now is a Tom Heinsohn painting. You know, he's a noted artist.
Mm-hmm.
And we were friendly, and it was fine. You know, that was the circumstance of the time, and we patched it up a long time ago. Well, you go read a book, by the way, that he wrote, it excoriates me. It called me a cancer. That was, in the time, and people still Wikipedia, they cite that. But the fact of the matter is, they don't know that Tommy and I patched it up a long time ago.
Right. Well, I also think too, it sort of bespeaks of the time when a writer had so much influence. I mean, I think his problem with you was that he probably felt the players trusted you, and he thought your influence encroached on his authority in some way. And it may have with your coverage, but that's how much power and respect you had as a journalist back then.
That's exactly it. Really, you're right. He was resentful of that and thought that there was people were going to, think, I had influence. And newspapers did. In those days, it was a different world completely. It's unimaginable today, right? No, that's really. I think you hit it upon the core of it. But I mean, I owed him a lot. I learned a lot of NBA from him. I learned a lot from the players. I learned a lot from everybody. Whatever happened. But anyway, that time. And I let me do one quick aside.
Go ahead. I
was staying at Westfall's house during those finals.
It's great.
Due to the time difference, on an off day, I was done writing by 2 or 3 in the afternoon because of the time difference on my deadline. And we go back to the pool and sit around the pool. Alvin Adams lived down the street. He'd come over, and there was one other guy who was the left off the roster of the Suns that year. But he was hanging around, and he needed, he was happy to have somewhere to go, something to do. Nice afternoon at the pool. Pat Riley.
So, that's great. I forgot Riles was even had a roster spot then.
I'll tell you something else about Riles. In the early 80s, when he first took over the Lakers, he actually wrote in 82, when they beat the 76, his second championship, because he won in 80. After succeeding, West End, he wrote handwritten thank you notes to several members of the media for the coverage.
Oh, man.
And I was recipient of one of those notes. That's the way the world was.
Do you still have that note?
No, I wish I had that one. I have some stuff, but
that's a different world. Was.
Yeah.
Wow. But no use sounding like the old men yelling at the clouds, but let's do it for a heck of it anyway. I could keep you forever, but I do want to get to Bird, because Larry Bird has such, to this day, is a mythical quality. And I think part of it is, for better or worse, and probably who cares nowadays, because there's so many crossover stars, but he was the last great American born white superstar. Like I cannot think of anybody since him that's taken over that kind of mantle. And I remember, Billy Hunter, the executive player at the signing, said, this league will struggle if it doesn't get another Larry Bird. Well, that's not true anymore. No, the league is fostered, and maybe it's because of changing societal attitudes. I also think it's the influx and people getting used to European players. And actually, you didn't know when Dirk came in, nobody knew him. He hadn't played college or anything. Like, who's this big, And then all of a sudden he's developed and he's turned into this game and he became like a household name. But gosh, you're to this day, your relationship with Larry is very good, right?
Very good.
Yeah, can I have his number? Because I want to get him on the show.
But, you know, right, all the guys, all the Caucasians now, or the lighter-skinned guys now, are Europeans. The big, big stars. Big men, you know, Doncic and Jokic. And,
oh, and the skill level is off the charts.
Yeah, obviously. Larry. Larry Bird grew up in public, as do all these guys do. But in his case, it was very interesting because Larry Bird was a bright guy who had grown up in a specific area of the country, southwestern Louisiana, Indiana, where there was no value priced on upward mobility, no value placed on education. And if he had not been 6 feet nine and with the talent that he had, he probably would have wound up spending his whole life there, being just another guy, you know, that was born there, worked there, died there, and, you know, the world would never know about him. But Larry Bird was that rarity. When he got to Boston, he began to blossom. He began to see the world, a bigger world. And to the point where many years down the road, I wrote a column for a story for the Boston Sunday Magazine about the blossoming of Larry Bird and how he had learned to manipulate the media and handle the media and enjoy the interaction, something like Sean, the first time I met him, Mike, ever met him, was the summer of 80. And I was commissioned to do a story for the late lamented Us magazine, the People magazine, AAA competitor of the time. And it was, the interview was conducted at his agent, Bob Wolf's house, which is like around the corner from his house, because he wouldn't let any media into his house. And he made it clear, I'll do my, and one of the things he told me off the record, you know, I mean, and as we did the story, was I'll do my duties with the media, but I'm not, no one's ever going to come to my house or anything. The idea that he could ever become friendly with a member of the media was so alien to him. He just was wary, suspicious.
He was a friend, hick from French Lick still.
Yeah, I won't go to say hostile, but suspicious and wary and worrisome. And, you know, well, we hit it off right away. We became friendly, and he asked me to do his book, and I did his first book, Drive. And
Drive was one of the books that it was my senior year. I don't want to make you feel a little bit senior year of college, and I got it, and I was mesmerized, and I'm like, I want to write a book like that one day, and I just remember now I didn't know I would be ghostwriting Shaq's book. It was a little weird doing that at like whatever he was, 30. But you got Larry Bird. Like to see that you had so much, there was so much richness. And I remember, tell me if this is right or not. Mm-hmm. I remember reading interviews about that afterwards. And it was either Bob Wolf or somebody that they thought that there Larry had some ugly, nasty fights when he was younger. And they wanted to take that out of the book because they thought it made him too rough-edged. And they went, and Bird didn't care, but his people cared because they didn't want that part of Larry Bird, you know, coming out there. And I remember you talking about that. I'm thinking those must be great stories that never even got out.
Well, that's all true. And Bob Wolf had Larry's influence, you know, influenced Larry. And one of the, I think the phrase was one of the ones the grandmothers would like, you know, the final product was homogenized to an extent, you know, and it wasn't false. It wasn't
still great.
It wasn't falsified. But there were some things left out, of course. But I was honored and thrilled to be able to do it. And of course it was, you know, it was a good success and all that. But Larry, I'm very fond of Larry. And of course, one of the great fun things about that book was that, in case anybody's wondering, his friendship with Magic is legit. And Magic did the foreword for the book, and then the day that Magic announced to the world that he was HIV positive, one of the first people he called was Larry. The day that Larry retired, one of the first people he recalled was Magic. They have maintained a friendship over the years. It's all for real.
Yeah, and, that's,
you know, I want people to know that. That it is all for real.
I think I never thought it was fun. I remember Bird was famous for. He'd duck out on the Boston media, but he'd meet some ladies in Utah for a pie. They'd show up, like, hi, Larry, and they bring him a pie in the hotel lobby. Or he'd go and spend time with some local yokel reporter that he just thought was interesting. And I talked him into, when I was covering high school sports in Sacramento for the Union, I don't even remember Don Drysdale. He was a heavy set guy that used to cover the Kings. They gave me the backup for a while. And I remember, and I go, I want to do a story on Bird. They go, Bird won't talk to you. And then sure enough, I talked them into, you know, I go, can you go, will you go to lunch with me tomorrow at the Hyatt Regency? And I've been literally following the Celtics bus back. And sure enough, that was like a week after, it was his last season, a week after. And he told me he cried when Magic called him and he just broke down. And yeah. And I was like, wow, this, the respect level was so much even deeper than the competition and the love for each other. And it's one of the, like even that play that they showed on Broadway yeah. doesn't really do it justice.
No, it doesn't. It was an interesting idea. Yeah. I used to kid Larry, you know, when I realized as the years gone on and years went on and I realized how bright he really was, I used to kid him. I said, you successfully evaded the American educational system for 20 years. but he's, because I one accurate prediction I made, and I did say it at the time, that if there was somebody in that period of time in that talent pool who could be the next Jerry West, i.e. a superstar player who could be a successful executive, it was Larry Bird. I just thought his innate instinct for and you know, I think
what's the great, go ahead, I cut you off.
He was even an executive with Indiana, and of course as a coach, the coaching thing was phenomenal. It was fabulous because he said 3 years. Yeah, no one lives up to that promise. He said 3 years, that's it. Guess what? 3 years. He goes he goes to the finals. You know, they didn't have a chance, but he got them to the finals. But the one that killed them, though, Mike, was the year they lost to the Bulls.
Game 7. He's right there. He's right there. I'm in that game, too. Ah. And to this day, I'm like going, Mark Jackson had a couple turnovers at the end. And I just go, like, God, they had that. They had their number. They had Michael Jordan in a Game 7.
Remember the jump ball? And Larry blames himself to his grave. He will blame himself. He didn't think he positioned them well. There was a big jump ball, like 20
seconds. Oh, that's right.
He blames himself for that. Okay, here's the thing that drives him crazy.
Yeah.
If they win, they're playing the Jazz.
Yeah.
They had swept the Jazz. They toyed with the Jazz. Oh, they had the Jazz.
He's winning it all.
The Jazz. You know,
although that's a great series. Stockton and Malone were at their peak at that point.
Yeah, but they owned them, he said.
Yeah, okay.
And they did. I don't know. He said.
They had the bodies. They had the depth. I mean, yeah. The Jazz, that was the Jazz thing behind Malone and Stockton. They had all these bodies. They had all these great role players. Well, so did the Pacers behind Reggie and that crew. They just, you know, Rick Smits and all those guys.
Harry did it 3 years. And as he said, he quit. He never did it again.
That's great. It was like, is he even working now? Is other than a consultant, or is he just hanging out in Naples?
I think he's still on the payroll. I got to go talk to him. I'm talking for a little while. He's still on the payroll, but you know, he's living in Florida for the most part. I think I'm sure he's there now.
Most amazing thing that Bob Ryan saw Bird do on the court.
Yeah.
What was the most amazing thing that you saw him ever do on the court?
The most amazing thing I ever saw him do on the court.
One guy said, I read this years ago, that maybe it was Pete, remember Pete Axthelm? He did a great story about he sat next to his brother Eddie, but you know, of course, Eddie's, you know, hey Eddie, and one time he picked up a flat ball and threw it across the court at our
house. My favorite, that's so many, but one of the things I think that separated him from, and of course, Magic, you could say the same thing. From Michael, and Michael's the greatest virtuoso. I just told you that a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Ever played, but Larry could do something, and Magic could do something. But Larry, more specifically, amazing because of nobody ever in the history of this game accomplished more with the ball in his hands less. In other words, you know, talking about LeBron. He and LeBron are the two greatest passing forwards of all time. But LeBron's got the ball all the damn time. Larry did not have the ball all the damn time. Larry saw them 2 steps ahead. Okay. Larry Bird could control games without scoring more than any non-point guard in the history of basketball. Okay.
I'm stealing that.
In a way that Michael couldn't even dream of. One night in Phoenix, I remember this one. We're in Phoenix and they're down big at the half. And they come out and they have a huge third quarter. And they come back and they eventually win the game. And Larry Bird controlled the entire game in the third quarter, and he never took a shot. He had like 7 assists. And Michael couldn't – that's not Michael's game.
Yeah. So that's,
and think about this. Nobody accomplished more with the ball in his hands less than Larry Bird.
He was like
– never been. Now, they talk now Doncic, and I know there's the Times did a big story the other day comparing Doncic and Larry, and it's very – and You know, that's very interesting. There's a lot in common, but Doncic's got the ball a lot. I'm telling you, Larry never had the ball as much. Larry got more done without having the ball in his hands than any person.
I always hate those comparisons, like take the great white guy and compare to the great white. Like,
yeah, I know.
I mean, they have a lot of the same skill set and everything, but they were just different players. They were so different.
Guilty. I know.
Yeah, no, it's
I summarize it this way, Mike. 1979, when Larry came into the league, I was 10 years covering the Celtics.
Okay.
And I was equated to this. If I had been an art student and signed up for a course, not knowing who the instructor was going to be, and into that classroom on day one was Michelangelo. That's the way I felt about Larry Bird entering my life as a basketball fan.
You know why I know that? I remember that. You wrote the day he retired. You wrote something like that. I mean, was that the day that you retired? Like your lead was something like, just imagine if you were seeing Michelangelo paint the top of the Sistine Chapel, and there was a couple other metaphors, and they all made sense, and it was about greatness. There was so individual. There was like historical greatness that nobody could pull off.
Well, thank you.
How did I remember that? God, you should sign part of my body, other than it would be really awkward.
And it energized me. And, you know, I never wrote more about anybody than Larry Bird. I wrote more words about Larry Bird than anyone else in my 44 year career at the Globe. And he inspired me to move me to the highest, you know, literary capability that I possessed. you felt some nights. I mean, I know I used this reference on a couple of occasions for sure. You need the thesaurus. I'm out of it. I'm done. He's done it more. I don't have anything more to higher level of praise, you know, than I already gave you. This is what it's like covering Larry Bird. And so I'm forever grateful that he came into my, you know, life personally and professionally. It was a blessing. It really was.
Yeah, before I get to a real quick finish with a few modern day Celtic questions, you know, about the loss, and I sent you a quick email, but I never really had a conversation with you about it. You lost your son in 2008, and awkward transition, but I think like we talk about all these things that happened over the last year, and I thought to myself, and of course I'm a dad now, and I've got, I started really late, and I got a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old. And it made me even more, I went back and read about your son, and one, sound like a tremendous kid, but more than that, like any parent, no parent should ever outlive their kids. And it's wrong on so many levels. And if I hadn't told you, I'm sorry. And I know that it's now 13 years, but I'm sure that you still carry a lot of that with you.
No one's prepared for that. And it's a club you don't want to join. Of course, and I certainly relate to anyone who has also been sadly inducted into that club. Yeah, it's shattering. And the great blessing in our life is that he left behind triplet grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
and who are now 21 years old.
Wow!
And one of them is living with us, has been living with us for the school year because her, you know, she's going to school remotely, and she finds the logistics with us are actually, you know, just very good. And so she's been living with us, and it's been just fantastic having her with us. And of course, you know, we're very, you know, we love her brother and two brothers, and, you know, we have that, you know, so, you know, you fasten onto them. What can you do? You know,
you probably tell them stories about him.
Yeah, exactly. And we, you know, we talk about him, and of course she can see, all kinds of evidence of his presence in our house, of course, and that's really good. But you get over it, but it never leaves you. And I appreciate you, you know, bringing it up.
If people don't know out there, he was Bob's son was U.S. diplomat Keith Ryan, and he died in Pakistan. Was there any closure with you and the family, or is it still somewhat of a mystery?
Sadly, there is no closure. It is.
She really don't. I mean, there was people said suicide, but there he obviously held a lot of dangerous positions in his life, and he was an important person in the U.S. government. You still don't know.
No, and
which is that to me is that's the worst.
Yeah, it's that's the way that's where it stands, and maybe someday we will get a final resolution, but it's very difficult to negotiate these waters but. We think most about how are the kids, how have they adjusted to the reality of it? And they've been remarkably, I hate to use that word, but not the resilient. You don't know ultimately what's going on in their heads, but they appear on all odds to have, really come through this as well as you could hope.
And did someone like Bert ever reach out to you because he lost his father?
No, he didn't. I'll tell you, a couple coaches did. A lot of people, but there's certain people I don't want to, one that a lot of people have their mixed opinions on, but I always recuse myself when I discuss him because he was the most solicitous at the time and over for the next several years. And I think that's the true side of him. I'll let that go at that. But there are plenty of people. We were obviously the world responded very graciously to us.
Yeah. I'm just glad we could talk about him and celebrate his life a little bit. And that he's got, I know the kids were, they're from, they grew up in Silver Spring, didn't they?
They were in Silver
Spring. Just like 10 minutes from me.
No, they were. They were living at the time they were living at Silver Spring. And
okay.
They've since relocated to Longmeadow, Massachusetts. And that's where they grew up. They went to high school.
That, good that, field that, hockey teams.
Yes, and Ross.
I don't know how I know that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful town, and they've been really happy there, and it treated them very well.
All right, let's. I'm going to wrap some of these quick ones here. The current Celtics team really stumbled this season, losing Gordon Hayward for nothing has left a real void. Danny Ainge yet to fill. Could have had Miles Turner, Doug McDermott. What do you do with this team? Marcus Smart is something of a latter day Casey Jones as a player, but Boston's missed him terribly. Great guy, but doesn't accept mediocrity and will rattle some cages in the locker room. When he returns, what improves for the Celtics, and can they make a run of some sort?
I think people are overreacting myself. I'm holding on. First of all, just count me on as a member of the Brad Stevens fan club, and he is not the problem. He is not the problem. It's a personnel problem. One thing Danny Ainge has not been able to do in the last 2 years is find someone, a reliable scorer off the bench. Someone who, as I like to kiddingly put it, puts on his income tax return under occupation, registered jump shooter. They need the closest thing to Lou Williams that's out there that's not Lou Williams. They're not getting him. They need somebody that can come into the game and change the game offensively. They don't have that guy.
They need Ray Allen 2011.
They don't have that 10, guy. 10. They don't have that guy. Marcus Smart has missed 15 games in a row, and is not there's no specific date for his return. He's vitally important. He's one of those guys that transcends the stat sheet so much that he's an irreplaceable player. Kemba Walker is on an every other game basis, and a very interesting thing, and not surprising that he's had four excellent games in a row, each of which after he's had a day off. They've been going on every other game basis. So maybe by the real important games, because they'll sneak into the playoffs still, I think, and that he'll be available, and that'll make a difference. But they're those, and then of course they have struggled. They've had a five man by committee, for like 3 years, but they've got a rising, interesting presence in Robert Williams, who they drafted near the end of the first round a couple years ago from Texas A&M, who is a 7-footer with a great athletic ability, who was hurt all the time. First of all, he's making an impact lately. He's making an impact. And he might turn out to be somebody who they can really rely on. If he gets to the point where they can rely on him, that's going to change a lot. So don't write them off completely, but it has been a bad siege lately. The other thing is Jason Tatum had COVID.
I forgot about that, and
said I'm not the same. I don't feel the same, and his shooting percentage is going since he's come back. And he's in the All-Star game based on what he did until he got sick, but He's not the same player right now. Jaylen Brown, though, we have no complaints. Jaylen Brown has elevated himself. He's as good as he's ever going to be, which is a lot. He's in the All-Star game. Anyway, long story.
I think Tatum is an MVP candidate in a couple of years, the way keeps going.
But right now his shooting percentage is down.
Yeah.
But he's still a kid. He's still 22 years old. It's hard to
imagine. Exactly.
And so they're not as bad as they look now. They cannot be, and they won't be when they get Smart back. And if they can get Kemba playing on a regular basis in the playoffs, they won't be as bad. But that still leaves the fact that they don't have that scoring punch off the bench.
And even if they don't have a great season, or they don't make the play, or they don't go anywhere, you have got to feel spoiled as a Bostonian over the last. I mean, I was thinking this the other day when Washington first had a championship parade for the Capitals and whatever it was 3 years ago. That was like first time in 29 years since Joe Gibbs won it in 92. Like it, as a Washington, among the four major North American sports leagues, I was looking like you guys were having a parade every other year. It was incredible.
We had 12 parades since the dawn of the 21st century and 6 finals, not including the MLS where they went to the finals 3 straight times or the NCAA hockey championships that have been won by
BU
in Boston College. No, we've had the best beginning of the 20th century of any city in America, and sooner or later, there had to be a market correction. I am perfectly sanguine.
The Red Sox are horrible now.
Right, I have no problem with it, and I'm in the minority. People have gotten sadly spoiled. Come on. You know,
isn't there a billboard like so and so day since our last championship parade, which is just insufferable to teams like, in San Diego that's never ever actually won something?
I'm in the minority. There's an entitlement mentality that pervades, and each sport has its own set of fans that I don't understand this. I've never been like this, only concentrate on one team. I don't understand that, but that's the way they are. So Celtic fans are feeling sorry for themselves. Patriot fan, can you imagine the absolute gall of any Patriot fan feeling sorry for him or herself after this year? They're out there, and the Red Sox 4 championships since 2004. Last year stunk. And they're not going to be very good this year, but they're not going to be as horrible, I don't think, as people think. But you got no right to complain if you look at the big picture. But people, if you only follow one sport, you only worry about your own. And I don't relate to that. Never could.
No, I never will as well. Well, this has been incredible. Thank you so much for the time. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, I knew I made it in the business when I got back to my room at the Sydney Olympics. And Bill Roden and a couple other guys go, hey, where were you? And I go, oh, Bob Ryan and I went out for beers. We had Victoria Bitters at some place in Sydney after we covered a basketball game. And he goes, you went out with Bob Ryan? Oh, my God, you've made it. And so I just wanted to thank you for, it's one thing for me to act like I'm working at a game and it's no big deal. But, boy, I never tried to show it. But, gosh, you and Sam Smith, people like that, Rick Tellender, Shaughnessy, other bit. When you guys would be talking you guys would ask me questions on the outside about the Knicks or something, I'd try and answer it like that. Really, I was just in awe. The fact that you even put me, like, welcome me into your group for a little bit, it was very flattering, and it made me feel like I belonged after working at like the shit jobs of the century. And at any rate, so if I didn't tell you that before I let you go, I wouldn't feel
very,
like
very, very kind of you said that, Mike. You're being explicitly modest, but I truly appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to you. I hope Elaine, your whole family is safe and healthy. And
so far, so good in that score, believe me.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Thank you, sir.
That was dope.
Thanks to my guest, the great American sports writer and basically human being, Bob Ryan. Also, thanks to my producer, Bruce Bernstein, who is now going to read some of these promos.
Why, thank you, Mike. We want to also say thank you to Kristen Woolley, our editor. Kristen, you're the best.
Holla, Kristen.
Holla. Please check out all of our Pure Hoops Media shows. Full Court with Jenny Fisher and Kara Kay has the best in college hoop each Tuesday. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin. It's here every Wednesday. Last week, they welcomed Brian Lewis of the New York Post, and they did a great James Harden, Kyrie Irving breakdown. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Mike's good friend Monica McNutt and King McClure drops on Thursday. And this past week, they had Jay Billis of ESPN, who is definitely one of the most interesting men in the world. BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman have the Pure Hoops podcast each Friday. And of course, Mike is back every Monday with a new Mike Wise show. We also have a YouTube channel with a ton of great segments you can check out, including Mike's very unplugged conversation with Lakers governor Jeannie Buss. Go to the YouTube channel and search for Pure Hoops Media, Mike.
I'm really jealous, King, Monica, that you got to talk to Jay Billis before me. Jay's one of my favorite people. Hopefully the year 2021 is when we get rid of this stupid pandemic and get it out as quickly as possible. When you qualify for the vaccination, I mean, this is not a political statement. Do the right thing. Go get it. But until that day arrives, keep your guard up. Wear the mask in public to protect yourselves and others. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and be considerate of others. I know we've been doing this for so long, and it's just our world now, but let's just try and do it until, shoot, whether it's this time next year, whether it's in 6 months, we can knock this out. And keep all our medical professionals in your prayers. Until next time, peace.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.